Hello, everybody. Thank you for coming to this session. Just a reminder that there was a weather incident that caused a change in the session today. So the title is different. The title for this session is Blended Learning Meets MOOCs, Education's Digital Future. On behalf of the ELI Programming Committee, I'm honored to introduce our speaker, Tony Picciano. Tony is the Executive Officer and Professor of the PhD Program in Urban Education at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. He is also a professor in the graduate program in education leadership at Hunter College, the interactive pedagogy and technology program at the Graduate Center, and the online BA program in communication and culture at the School of Professional Studies. He has 40 years of experience in education administration and teaching, and has been involved in a number of major grants from the U.S. Department of Education, the National Science Foundation, IBM, and the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. He is also a founding member of the board of directors for the Sloan Consortium. Tony is author of 9 books on education, research methods, and technology. He is currently working with Jeff Seaman on a national study of online learning and its role in the reform of American high schools. Please join me in welcoming Tony Picciano.
Thank you, Kristen. I appreciate it. As many of you know, I think it was announced by Malcolm this morning that I'm a substitute. One of our colleagues is stuck in New York, and as someone who comes from New York, I can appreciate the problem he has the Monday after the Super Bowl. Trying to get out of New York or New Jersey airports was impossible to begin with. At about 8 or 9 inches of snow, and it becomes I think he's still at the airport trying to get a plane here, but I'm only kidding. But he was not able to make it. So I'm a substitute, and I'll be doing the session today. This is a presentation that parts of which I've done in the past, but I updated it significantly in November of 2013, this past November. And there were a couple of developments that have moved me in this direction. If any of you were here at the earlier session, I've done a lot of work with online technology, particularly blended learning, over the last dozen or so years. And over the last few years, we've had the tsunami, as some people say, of MOOCs. And in November, I was privileged that at our conference in Orlando for the Sloan Consortium, we had Daphne Kolner, who is the founder of Coursera, and Arant Agarwal, who's the founder of edX, as our plenary speakers, and I had a chance to discuss various aspects of MOOC technology and blended learning. I'll share some of that with you. But the story I'd like to start off with was, as many of you know, there was the rollout of Udacity's courses at San Jose State University this past year. A very good colleague of mine, Kathy Cheel, who's the Associate Provost, Vice President for technology there, instructional technology. She was responsible for it. And we had a great conversation in December about how that rollout went. There's been a lot in the press, but I will give you some insights there in terms of how what was going to be a fully MOOC environment ended up a blended environment. So those are kinds of things that happened in the last 2 or 3 months and has moved me to update a little bit of what I'll be talking about today. So this isn't just some old hat presentation. In terms of how I was chosen by Malcolm and Veronica, I happened to be speaking with them last evening when this issue evolved where the speaker cannot get out of Newark Airport. And I faced a similar situation about 5 or 6 years ago at a conference we had at Sloan. And so I just offered, and they were very gracious to accept it. So I thank you for coming. So we're looking at blended learning, and we know that online technology is manifesting itself in all kinds of ways. Access to the internet is truly ubiquitous now, and we can log on almost at any place and any time. For my presentation today, I'll give some introduction, which actually I've already done some of it. But I want to move into blended learning, and I'll talk about definitions and the problems with definitions. I will also talk about MOOCs a great deal. And it's my conclusion that for the foreseeable future, that we're moving to a MOOC blended learning environment, more blended learning than MOOC, I would probably say. And I'll presented with some basis in terms of what I've observed, but also I'll provide some data for you that might lead us in that direction. So teaching and learning in 2014, there's all different scenarios. We have the on-ground or face-to-face presentation or lecture. Increasingly in a lot of our institutions, these lectures are getting larger and larger with hundreds and hundreds of students, mostly for financial reasons, not for pedagogical reasons. This has been evolving for a couple of decades now, particularly in some of our public institutions and the private institutions that are not well endowed. We, in the 1990s, we moved to online learning as a pedagogically viable way to deliver instruction in higher education. We are very much interested in engagement, and I'd like to point out in this particular slide, if you can see it, the student's pencil is down, and when he's got the eraser down, he's fully involved and trying to figure out what's going on in the class on his monitor and comparing it to what's going on in the book that's in front of him. That, to me, is indicative of an engaged student. But we also have concerns that some of our students are not as engaged. And for those of us who teach, we always wonder what's going on with our students who have their iPads out and their laptops and their PDAs. And you're hoping that they're, you know, very, very conscientiously taking notes of all the good things that are being presented in the class, but we know many of them are not necessarily doing that. They are miles and miles away. So these are the scenarios that we're working with in higher education today. There are many more, but this is a good start in terms of looking at the differences. And also in terms of, we have a lot of discussion about the differences in the generations. I have not always subscribed to the digital native, digital immigrant theory, but maybe this is something that will kind of brings it to bear. But I presume that you can see that basically here are a couple of parents, probably my generation. Dear Andy, how have you been? Your mother and I are fine. We miss you. Please sign off your computer and come downstairs for something to eat. Love, Dad. It's indicative of how turned on many of us are, but especially our young people, in terms of what they do with technology. And it's also used sometimes as a knock on faculty, that the faculty are not keeping up with the students. I'm not sure that's true, but we can talk about that later. Fundamentally, what I'd like to discuss is a definition of blended learning. For those of you here in the earlier session, I made a comment that in 2003, a group of us at the University of Illinois in Chicago, where we invited about 30 well-informed, experienced educators who had done online learning, we attempted to have our first workshop on this phenomena, which we called online learning, and we attempted to define it in the first hour of the workshop. We were not able to do it then. It took us something like 8 or 9 months to arrive at some kind of, I would say, conceptual definition of it. It was not perfect by any means. It's still not perfect. In the last 10 years, I would say the definition has become murkier and murkier. But we did try, and rather than just a single continuum of something that's face-to-face and something that's online, we developed something of the following, where at least we put another dimension that attempted to account for the types of technology that were being used. And if you look at this, you can see that we have this two-dimensional kind of conceptual model of blended learning. I think it's okay, but there have been so many permutations of blended learning that it's not adequate enough. I think we need to do more of it. But as my colleague Chuck Jubin said early this morning, maybe it's good we don't have a good definition of this. We have some conceptual idea, and it's different definitely from institution to institution, and even within institutions from faculty member to faculty member and instructional designer and instructional designer. So, blended learning. I wrote a paper in 2009 after having studied blended learning for a bit, and it was my sense that the fundamental purpose that we developed blended learning and why it was becoming popular was mainly for its pedagogy, that we were making decisions not just for the technological reasons in terms of what technology was available and what the online environment afforded us, but we were making decisions for pedagogical reasons. And I'll share a little story about my own teaching. I was teaching a research methods for a graduate course at Hunter College in New York City. And we had, my colleagues and I, we had converted several of our courses into fully online environment. And I had developed, I think, about five or six courses by then, mostly courses that allowed students to think about topics such as education policy, to reflect on it, to respond to myself, to the material, to each other. Those courses worked very, very well in an online environment. I felt I was teaching well, and the students, I think, felt that they were getting something out of it. But then I decided to teach an Introduction to Research Methods course. There are several components to that course. Part of it is evaluating research that exists in the field. That part of it I was able to do very well online. But then there was a 3 or 4 week intensive, you know, immersion in quantitative methods and statistics. Now, the graduate program I teach in was education leadership. Most of, if not all of my teachers were experienced educators. They were teachers. They were lower level administrators who wanted to become principals. And unfortunately, in many of the schools of education in this country, in the 70s, 80s, well, late 70s, 80s, and 90s, they had moved away from quantitative research. And many of my students, although they were very, very effective teachers in their public schools and had had, all of whom had had master's degrees prior to coming into our program, which was 38 credits above the master's level, they were able to avoid quantitative research throughout their academic careers for the most part. They had weak statistical skills, weak quantitative skills, weak basic mathematical skills. And when I tried to teach that online, I struggled with that. I had a real problem getting across to students. I developed videos, I developed exercises, but I did not feel that I was doing a good job of it. And I'm of a mind that as we move in any technology, whether it's fully online, other kinds of technology, while while the students should be satisfied and we have a plethora of studies on student satisfaction, faculty have to be satisfied and happy what they're doing also. And I felt with this particular module, in terms of quantitative methods, I was not being effective. And I tried it 2 or 3 times, and literally I gave up on it, to be quite honest with you. I was not able to do it to the level that I wanted to do it. And so I replaced that 3 or 4 week module into an intensive weekend. So the students came in on a Saturday and Sunday, and Hunter College, if you don't know, City University of New York, we have 500,000 students in 300 square miles of the New York City metropolitan area. Almost all of our students come to our classes via public transportation, particularly those of us who teach in Manhattan. And many of my students lived, in some cases, within walking distance of my college, Hunter, on 68th Street and Lexington Avenue. So having them come in for a weekend, as long as I was going to be letting them know a good month and a half, almost 2 months in advance, that we're going to be doing this weekend intensive online, intensive face-to-face work in quantitative methods, it was okay with them. And I found that was a much better experience. And what was important to me, or important to what I felt was successful, was the fact that a lot of these students, in looking at some procedure, anything from simple descriptive statistics to something more inferential, like a regression or correlation research, they had problems with some of the basic arithmetic concepts and the basic statistical concepts. So it was a leap for them to look at, you know, regression analysis. It was not easy for them to do it. And in exercises, they were getting stuck on very, very basic procedures. And for them to have waited, and our online courses, by the way, were almost all asynchronous. They were not synchronous. We were not getting on online at the same time, although I did try that a couple of times. And so they were getting frustrated that they had to wait a while to ask a question. And the questions were like, you know, I would have to respond to, you know, we'll look at chapter so-and-so in a textbook, because it wasn't just a quick answer. It was kind of involved. And so I moved all of the quantitative analysis into a face-to-face situation, an intensive weekend, a kind of immersion in statistics and quantitative research. And both for me and my students, that was a much better experience, I assure you. And I never taught statistics or quantitative methods, the actual methods, online again. There's a lot of good material out there. There's a lot of good software. William Bowen, formerly at the president of Princeton and at Carnegie, they developed some very good modules on statistics. But for me, back in the early 2000s, it was a struggle, and I moved away from that, and I never went back, to be quite honest with you. And that started me working with blended learning, that there was things that I, as a faculty member, wanted to do that just were not easy for me to do online. So, and that led to some other work, and in 2009, I put some of these ideas into a paper, which basically I call Blending with Purpose, which has been fairly well received and referenced a lot. And fundamental to the concept here in this multimodal model is that it's the pedagogy that drives the technology, not the technology that drives the pedagogy. And so we can look at different scenarios. We can look at, for instance, many of our courses, most of our courses have some kind of content that is presented, quote-unquote, delivered. We have a lot of technology. We have learning management systems. We have course management systems that have been around for a good 15 years or more. But we've moved into other kinds of technology, multi-user virtual environments, gaming, all of which are designed to provide students a way of being exposed to content. And in some of the newer iterations, such as gaming, such as the virtual environments, it's an active environment. It's an active involvement with the content. So I think this is one step in this model in terms of delivering content using technology that might make it more engaging for the students. We also look at, you know, the social and emotional side of teaching and learning. And I've had the pleasure of teaching undergraduates. I've had the pleasure of teaching graduate students. For the last 7 years, I'm teaching mostly doctoral students. And it never, ever surprises me the emotional issues that students have, whether it has to do with family, whether it has to do with even confidence in whether they should be in a program or in a course. And it could be just in terms of career issues and aspirations, or maybe questioning their aspirations. But there's a lot of face-to-face kind of social emotional activities that go on. Now, I've taught a lot of courses online and blended and fully online. I know I can develop an interaction with students and I can engage them. But sometimes for some of these more serious issues, I've always thought that the face-to-face environment was far more effective in my own experience. Dialectic and questioning, those of us who go back a little bit, I mean, Chuck and I go back to Socrates and the dialectics and, you know, the Socratic method in terms of questioning. To me, that's a very, very effective and popular way to get students to voice opinion, to tear issues apart. And most of you, I'm sure, familiar with it. You ask the open-ended question. You ask it in a class. You know, you ask the whys and the hows and what do you thinks, more so than the whats or the whos. And you can engage an audience in a discussion or a class in a discussion. Online, that works very, very well. The simplest discussion board, even if you augment it with a blog or some other electronic interaction, to me, Socratic method is alive and well in the online environment. In many ways, it's maybe even more effective because if you do it asynchronously, you don't have to have the whole discussion within the space of minutes. You can have the discussion over the space of days. You allow students a lot more time to think about the questions that you're proposing, and that allows them to maybe formulate a more effective response, or more a response that reflects more their thinking. In the spur of the moment, you know, sometimes you get this idea 40 minutes after that part of the discussion's over, and the students really don't have the opportunity to ask that. But in an asynchronous environment, you can keep it going on for a couple of days or more if you want. In terms of reflection, those of us, any of you educators, teacher education programs, in the audience, any of you, well, if you read John Dewey, going back to the turn of the 20th century, reflection has become a very important part of what we do in education. Teachers reflect on how they teach. Students reflect upon what they've learned. And, you know, using a blog, whether it's an individual blog or a group blog, you can engage in a lot of important reflective practice where you encourage students, if not formally assign them, to think about what we learned this week, or what we learned in a particular book or some other readings. Reflection is a very powerful part of teaching and learning. And good teachers do it in terms of their teaching, and students who are engaged do it in terms of what they're learning in their classes. And then we have collaboration. Many of us who are engaged in professional programs, business, social work, health sciences, education, we value collaboration. It's part of the culture that we want to do things together. We want to encourage our students to work together. Well, to me, who used to do it both in the face-to-face as well as in the online environment, I find the online environment with wikis and blogs that allow for lots of exchanges of ideas, refining ideas, refining topics, sharing this with colleagues is a far more graceful way of doing it than it was doing face-to-face when students had to get together in the library or in the dining commons to meet on a Friday afternoon or Saturday morning whenever they had the time, whereas in a wiki in an online environment they can do the collaboration continuously in an asynchronous environment. And last but not least, we need to look at how we evaluate, how we assess what we do in our teaching, and we want to know what our students have learned. Hopefully we've set up some kind of objectives for the course. You can be more formal or less formal, that's up to your own style, but somehow we've established some reason why we're teaching this course and what we expect from the students. Well, we've moved to a point where not only can we give multiple choice tests, but we can do essays, we can do various types, require students to do presentations, we can ask them to do their PowerPoints online if you wish. Now students can make their own YouTube videos so they can do oral presentations either as individuals or as groups. But we have a lot of opportunities in the technology for students to, in a sense, do their assignments and for you to assess what they're doing. So this is a kind of model. I've called it blending with purpose, and the essential piece of it is that we set pedagogical objectives and we apply the right technology to those objectives. And I also want to emphasize that we should not think of this as, building blocks that we're putting, here's this online and that's over there face-to-face and this is something online. We don't think of it as building blocks. We think of more of it as a kind of two blends of paint. You blend red and you blend blue and you end up with purple, but it should be seamless. There's an aspect of it. And there's a colleague of mine, Steve Laster, who used to be at Harvard, is now with McGraw-Hill. He was the one who, I was the first to hear him talk about ecosystems. This is a good 6 or 7 years ago. But it's a graceful way of blending courses, of blending materials together in a kind of organic environment. And it is, quote-unquote, the artful design of teaching and learning experience that leverages instruction, technology, administrative, and support services into a natural experience for both learner and teacher. I emphasize that as much as we might emphasize, as much as I'm talking about teaching and learning and the role of the faculty member, none of this works well on the technology end with good support services and administration that is trying to provide the right kinds of resources for faculty and instructional designers to do what they want to do in their classes and in their courses and in their programs. So that's my homily on blended learning, and now we enter the MOOCs. The MOOCs came on in a big way a few years ago. I like this particular graphic, which I pulled off the web, which basically says massive open online courses. Every letter in that MOOC is negotiable. And as we've seen MOOCs rolled out and integrated with instruction, particularly in mainstream institutions, we know they're not as massive as they were. Well, there are still some MOOCs that have 150,000 students in them and tens of thousands of students. As they're being implemented in a lot of our mainstream institutions, they are being implemented with environments of or classes of about several hundred students, about the same size as some of our large lecture halls. Whether they're open, originally they were free, and now as they're moving into mainstream education, more and more colleges and universities are charging some fees for them. Not necessarily the full tuition, but they are charging something. In terms of online, originally the concept here online was that they were fully online. Again, as they're being introduced in a number of colleges and universities, they're actually more being introduced in a blended environment, whereas the faculty and the instructional designers are deciding to use the material, but having the faculty member there to somehow integrate that material into whatever he or she does, or maybe that the faculty member integrates what he or she does into the MOOC material. But more and more, we're moving to a blended environment. And lastly, in terms of a course, I'm not sure that these are courses as much as they're modules, and I think that might be the future of MOOC and MOOC technology, but we'll talk more about that in a few minutes. Pros and cons of MOOCs. To me, just as I indicated that the main attraction of blended learning was pedagogy, to me, the pedagogical aspects of blended learning, for me, I'm sorry, I guess I skipped the slide there, I apologize. For me, the pros of the MOOC technology, the major feature of it was its scalability. Back when Sebastian Troon offered his computer science course at Stanford to 160,000 students, there were other people doing MOOCs before that, but when he had 160,000 students enroll in his course, that really opened everybody's eyes. Educators, policymakers, 160,000 students, and there was an aspect of MOOCs that their scalability is something that we in higher education cannot ignore. There is something important about that, that we needed to explore. And fortunately or unfortunately, depending upon your view, the media, policymakers, and many educators, they kind of got into a MOOC pro and con. Many people initially were very, very impressed with all of this, particularly in terms of its scalability. And so faculty who I think tend to approach their teaching and learning in terms of the quality and the pedagogical aspects of a technology and what they do, a lot of other policymakers and I would say some administrators were looking at the scalability of MOOCs to see how they can save funding in some way, shape, or form, and resources. That is a well-respected approach in terms of how we administer anything, whether it's a school or a corporation or what have you. But there was a certain amount of grabbing on to this large scalability of MOOCs in terms of, wow, we can save money. And we had a number of situations and policymakers in places like Virginia and California where policymakers and trustees were saying, we're going to save a ton of money by moving a lot of our courses into a large-scale environment. That has not happened yet, but we'll talk more about that in a few minutes. The aspect of MOOCs followed a lot of, I would say, the evolution of online learning, where we found that a lot of it has appealed to older students, adults who are maybe a little bit organized, who have career aspirations, much more focused, that they have been successful in a lot of our online environments, and a lot of those type of adult learners also were the ones who were interested in MOOCs, and in some cases they were the more successful of many of the students who enrolled in a MOOC type course. And last but not least, we've heard several times in this conference over these last couple of days, you know, the development of learning analytics and big data. I do hope it does not become a kind of another buzzword that we tend to sometimes use in technology. I think there's something important there that's going on. And I think some of the really good work, in addition to a couple of colleges like Rio Salado and Purdue, where they've really rolled out some very interesting student monitoring systems. But in the MOOC environment, the learning analytics is almost part and parcel of it. And I think there's a lot of good development going on with the development of MOOC courses in this area that we should pay attention to. The cons. Most of the MOOC development has been at the course level. There are a few isolated programs developing. There's one down in Georgia in master's degree in computer science. But most of the MOOC development has been looking at courses, developing a course, attracting a faculty member from one of our universities to sit with a team of designers and developing a course. most of us know that taking a course, and even taking a course here and a course there, is not necessarily an education. There's much more into that in terms of, you know, going for a baccalaureate degree or a master's degree. And so taking a course on a MOOC is not equivalent to an education. And we need to look more about how would this all fit programmatically. Some of the early MOOCs were poorly designed, relying on video. My opinion of this, and I've said this many times, and I have a couple of colleagues here, Chuck and George, have probably heard me say this 50 times over the last 15 years. Videos beyond 15, 20 minutes are the best way to help you take a good nap. Too many of the materials developed with MOOCs were these long video introductions, even if they were simulations, but if there wasn't student engagement with them, and they went on for 40 minutes, 45 minutes, an hour, it was difficult for many people and many students to sit through these video. And it wasn't just one video. It was a basis of a lot of their introduction to the week's material. Very, very questionable pedagogical practice, at least in my view. Also, a lot of the follow-up and the assessment was this glorified listen and repeat sort of CAI type instruction that, you know, we were using this back in the 1960s and 70s, that even though you put it on a video screen doesn't necessarily make it better. But these were some of the early problems. I think they've moved further ahead with that, and some of the stuff that's coming out of places like Coursera and edX are much more pedagogically sound. But a lot of the early MOOCs were weak, I think, pedagogically. One of the issues that has probably attracted the most attention about MOOCs is that they have these very, very high attrition rates, as much as 90%. That cannot just be easily explained away. I'm not saying we have to make it as the reason why we're not going to engage in this kind of technology, but you can't just, you know, wish it away. We have to figure out models that, or how we can use this technology that we have more respectable response rates. We'll talk more about that in a few minutes. And last but not least, this is really an issue, I think, for mostly the MOOC providers. We have to realize that while Sebastian Troon got all this attraction and attention from the media when he offered his computer science course for 160,000 students, that this was not just Sebastian Troon doing his thing as a dedicated faculty member. Most of the major MOOC providers have substantial venture capital invested in their operations, tens of millions of dollars, mostly from Wall Street hedge fund type operations. And so the MOOC phenomenon was not just a faculty member here there doing some work as a pioneer. There was a lot of thought and a lot of investment in this. One thing about that kind of investment is they need a return at some point in time. How that return is going to be made in the MOOC environment, the way it's being deployed now, it makes a very difficult task of sustainability. And at some point in time, the investors are going to say, we want a return on that investment. And I'm not sure that the MOOC providers have figured that out, where they can, in a quote, make a profit on what they're doing. So those are some of the pros and cons. There are others, but I will not get into them today. Let's talk a little bit about the future. First, in terms of higher education, this is when you put together a presentation and you have to put it together at the last minute. I'm sorry. The future of technology and how we use it, it's easy to get it wrong. And these are a couple of my favorite quotes that I've collected over the years. For those of you who don't remember some of this, I don't blame you. I wasn't here for some of them. But in 1943, Thomas Watson, who was the chairman of IBM, for those of us who remember, IBM was the almost synonymous with technology, computer technology in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. He was quoted as saying, I think there is a world market for maybe 5 computers. That's why IBM has now sold most of their computer manufacturing to Lenovo, a Chinese firm, by the way, I think. I'm only kidding. In 1977, for those who remember, one of the real computer giants in the mini computer field was Digital Equipment Corporation. Ken Olson, who was the president of chairman of Digital Equipment, basically said, there is no reason anyone would want a computer in their home. Digital Equipment has basically It has become a vestige of what it once was. In the late 1970s, it was challenging IBM as one of the major computer companies in the world. And last but not least, for those of you who want to talk to me on the side, I'll make my comments about some of the funding we received from places like the Gates Foundation. But Bill Gates in 1981, 640,000 bytes ought to be enough memory for anybody. And we know that we're in the gigabyte world, and we are multitasking all over the place. And we, no matter how much memory our machines have, we still want more. And even in our iPads and in our portable devices. So, when we talk about the future, when we talk about technology, it's easy to get it wrong, even from well-informed individuals. I'm sorry, I'm a little bit disjointed with this particular slide. I'm not sure why, but you got the idea. Higher education, there's a lot of projections coming out in terms of higher education. We're in a little bit of a plateau right now, but basically the future for higher education, at least the data that I've been able to glean from the United States Department of Education, which in many ways I think they're getting better in collecting data about what's going on in education. They're also engaging some experts. Barbara Means is in the audience, who has done incredible work. I think for those of you who were at her session yesterday, there's a lot of important kernels of information there. And her meta-analysis in 2010, to me, is still one of the really important thresholds in educational research in this area. But in any case, the Department of Education is getting better, and their projections are that higher education is a growth industry. We're not worried in terms of some foreign country coming and taking our higher education away, although I have had one colleague who goes back and forth from China, and he tells me about this, but I don't necessarily believe him. But I do think we are in a growth, basically still a growth period in American higher education in terms of enrollments. But there's a slight difference, and this is a trend that started a good 20 years ago, that the nature of the students, there's no longer the traditional student, or there's much fewer of them than there used to be. The 18 to 20-year-old full-time residential student engaging in an undergraduate program is fastly becoming the minority. And the non-traditional student, those over the age of 21, 22, and is over the age of 35, in some cases over the age of 50, they are becoming a very, very significant, have become a very significant part of our enrollments in higher education, and that trend will continue. Also, in terms of looking at the future, and for those of you who have any background in teacher education, some of this relates to learning styles. If you accept that we learn differently, I believe in it, that we have different ways that we learn. There are things that we can do better. Some of us write better. Some of us can speak better. Some of us engage in reading, and we can read deeply and understand. And also, I believe it applies to teaching. Some of us have teaching styles, and some of it is related to the culture of our disciplines. How we teach biology is different than how we teach art history, is different than how we teach English composition. And you can go on and on. And so all of those differences have to come into play. Sorry again, I'm a little bit disjointed with this presentation in terms of the slides. And not one size will fit all. Basically, that is the point of this particular slide, that we have different students learn differently, we teach differently, and how we and depending upon our disciplines, we have a culture of how we want to teach and what we think is good teaching. And in terms of the future, if we look at one of the recent studies by my good colleague Jeff Seaman and his wife Elaine Allen, they've done 11 surveys now of higher education. And in terms of the MOOC phenomena, they started asking this question a year ago. And this is based upon data collected in 2012. Basically, you can see that in terms of the percentages, the number of schools or colleges actually offering MOOCs is a very, very small minority of schools, no more than about 3 or 4%. In terms of planning, a lot more colleges are planning to do that, but by no means is that the dominant percentage. Actually, the dominant percentage of colleges in terms of what they think about MOOCs is that they're undecided. They don't know what to do with this yet. And that reflects, I think, a lot of the thinking, both in public sector, private sector, et cetera. So now we come to the point where how do the MOOCs integrate with blended learning? And again, I want to mention this rollout at San Jose, which was a partnership between Udacity and San Jose State College in California, right in the middle of Silicon Valley. The original thought was that Udacity would develop a number of courses, mostly in introductory courses and remedial courses, which to me was a very, very big risk. For those of you who have ever had to teach students who have remedial needs in basic writing, reading, mathematics skills, that is a very, very difficult population to teach. To me, I've always said, not that I've taught a lot in the community colleges, I started my career as an adjunct in community colleges, but over the years, it's my opinion that the best teachers we have in American higher education are the teachers who are in the community colleges teaching for years and years, in some cases decades, students who have severe arithmetic, reading and writing skills. Much, much more difficult task than those of us who teach students at the graduate level who come in where we've selected, you know, one out of five students. We know that it's more our teaching in many cases, while we try and be engaging and interesting, it's more directing them than having to teach them and figuring out why they're not learning something. In the community colleges, again, for a lot of the remedial courses and the introductory courses, those students need a lot of teaching. But anyhow, the first rollout of MOOCs was going to be directed to introductory courses and remedial courses. I thought this was a risk. But anyhow, they decided not to direct or establish these courses for thousands and tens of thousands of students. They set a limit of about 300, 350 students per course. The tuition, it was not going to be free. The tuition was set at a nominal $150 per course. Provision for faculty environment, for faculty involvement was established, and so that all of these courses were implemented in a blended format. And then there was a significant effort to how to overcome one of the most severe criticisms of the MOOCs, and this was this 90% dropout rate. In terms of, this was data that was released last spring. There's some more data that came out this summer that changes some of this. But in terms of the first set of data on this rollout at San Jose State, you can see that in terms of this quote-unquote preliminary evaluation, that while they don't necessarily have the 90% dropout rate or withdrawal rate, these results are not stellar. Again, if you've ever taught in a community college with lots of students in remedial courses, you know it's difficult to get very, very high completion rates, particularly in, let's say, an algebra course or a mathematics course. But they're not particularly stellar. And so they've gone back to the drawing board. They're looking at their model again. They're redeveloping it. Unfortunately, I just received an email from my colleague, Kathy Cheel, who provided a lot of this information and insight into what's going on at San Jose, and she's planning on retiring this summer and going back to Michigan, so I have to develop another contact. And the other part of this that I think is important, in addition to Udacity's and Sebastian Troon's decision to go with a blended model at San Jose, I mentioned earlier that we had the founder of Coursera, Daphne Kolner, at a conference in Orlando in November, and we also had Aaron Agarwal from edX. And in speaking to them personally and also in hearing their presentation, both pretty much seemed to say that for the foreseeable future, that a lot of their materials would be used in a blended environment. And pushing them a little bit further, it was my interpretation, not that they said this directly, that they're really looking to be content providers, and that's where they think they will realize what they can offer to higher education in instructional technology. And I agree with that. And I think in some ways I welcome that. I think, again, they have a lot of resources. They've put a lot into thinking about teaching and learning. They still need to, I think, develop some more expertise on the pedagogical side, but they may do it. And I think that as content providers, they may have a place at the table of instructional technology in the years to come. So with that, I think I've exhausted my time almost, but I'll stick around for a few more minutes to answer any questions. In any case, to me, the future is that we will move towards a model that is blended. The MOOCs will help that, I think, that trend. And so I think we have a very interesting future ahead of us. I am not of the mind that, you know, MOOCs were here, they got all this hype, and then they were kicked in the rear because of their failures. I'm not of that, quite of that mind, although there was a lot written about that in the past year. Some of the leaders of the MOOC environment, I kind of think, asked for that. If you saw that Fast Company interview with Sebastian Troom where he says, "I have a lousy product," you can't just say that and say, A lot of people jumped on that to indicate that there's been a problem with the MOOCs. I am not of that mind. I think they have an important place to play in the evolution of instructional technology in higher education and secondary education. They just need to figure out how that's going to blend with the other things that have gone on before them. So thank you for your time. I appreciate it. Maybe I have time for a couple of questions. Do I have to call on somebody? Chuck, you have a question. Chuck, I'm going to give you a C if you don't ask a question. Anybody have a question? Well, thank you so much. I appreciate your attention. Have a good conference.